How about one more person? Yeah, great. Two, then. First, Heather, yeah. Speak up if you could, as best you can. Good. Yeah.
All of those resistances were met gently, not with too much time for any one particular.
That's wonderful, and I'm glad that happened for you. I suspect there are many people for whom that did not happen, you know? And, you know, I think it's really important to acknowledge that as well. And it reminds me of something, a quote I saw at this conference I was at yesterday from Jon Kabat-Zinn, one of the major proponents of mindfulness in the West, and particularly applying it in, you know, very mainstream settings. He said, you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. And I think that's where we go again with ardent, you know, diligent, resolute, you know, we just do it. Do the practice. You know, for me, exercise is such a metaphor because I don't care to do it. I like doing physical activities, including rock climbing. But, you know, going to the gym and lifting weights, oh my gosh. But whether I like it or not, I got to do it. Okay. How about you, and then I'll move on. Okay, right there. You were going to say something? Please.
Much to my surprise, in fact, I went completely sort of contrarian. And what you said about the safety, it was my kind of yes, but suddenly jumped up.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, in some ways, this is not so safe. I'd have been fine if you hadn't said anything.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so if you heard what she said, you know, it, again, not uncommonly, the intention to go left is often met with a strong desire to go right, or at least, you know, a rationale, if you will, to go right. And what often does come up for people around safety and also positive emotion, those are the two suggestions that are the most controversial and often, you know, stir up the most, what do you mean? You know, et cetera. Happiness is overrated. You know, although, as we'll get to later, two of the five factors of concentration laid out by the Buddha involved intense happiness. Very, very powerful, strong, positive emotion. So that said, it is also interesting that the way the brain organizes very much is yin-yang. In other words, it organizes around a combination and, or patterning of inhibition and excitation. Right, green lights and red lights. And so very often when we, as I said, aim to go, you know, yin, what comes up is yang. Or if we aim to go left, what comes up is right. Thesis, antithesis, of course. And then, okay, that's just more stuff to practice with. And then as it arises, what happens is there's a natural intelligence that emerges that goes, well, okay, we're not perfectly safe. I mean, there could be a terrible thing happening in the next moment, right? Or who knows what. But on the other hand, how much vigilance do I really need to establish, particularly for things that are completely outside of my control? Right? And then we do what we do in our own mind at that point. So that was great. Well, why don't I talk a little bit, if I could, about what hopefully or could have been happening in your brain, or sort of the best guess of Western science at this point. I'll do this slide fairly quickly because I've already alluded to many of the points. Setting an intention occurs top down and bottom up. Top down is from the prefrontal cortex. You don't need to remember any of the neuro stuff we do, but it's very interesting to kind of talk about it. And some of you may have a particular interest in it. Anyway, top down prefrontal cortex, verbally or non-verbally, verbal centers on the left side of the head for most people, especially right-handed people. You're directing basically and priming and biasing other parts of the brain to go in a certain direction. Establishing intention is very important. We also establish intention bottom up. You know, top down intentionality is kind of overrated. You know, a lot of intentionality comes bottom up from brainstem activation, being energized or alerting or orienting. Reward systems come basically bottom up, dopamine and other reward hormones are shot up in the brain like a rising fountain from brainstem regions. And then also there's the limbic system, subcortical, under the more modern brain. Cortex means bark. It's sort of the outside. The brain developed like a tree from the in evolution from the up and out. All right, and that out and around is the bark. And that's the cortex. Okay, I'm always trying to think of some clever joke I could make about barking like a dog, but it never works, so I won't even try to do it. And so when you imagine in particular kind of a heartfelt movement in a direction, ardent means heartfelt, enthusiastic, you know, warm. When we develop an emotional orientation in some direction or embody some person, those are very powerful ways to embody, you know, an intention from the bottom up. Next, relaxing. Relaxation is incredibly important. You'll find many, many instructions in all contemplative traditions that talk about tranquility. In the Anapanasati Sutta, which is about mindfulness of breathing, one of the major steps is to tranquilize the breath, to tranquilize the body formations, tranquilize the mind. And we move toward a greater calm. Why is that helpful? Well, one thing it does is it activates the parasympathetic wing of the autonomic nervous system. There's a part of the nervous system that manages equilibria, right? It keeps the body on an even keel, or attempts to at least, and responds to changing conditions. Well, one of the major sources of changing conditions is either great threat or great opportunity. In other words, great opportunity for aversion and hatred, if you will, in the Dharma, or great situation of opportunity or occasion for greed and, you know, grasping. Right? Sticks over here, carrots over there. When that happens, especially sticks over here, whoop, the sympathetic wing of the nervous system activates. That's the stress response, fight or flight wing of the nervous system. That's what happens inside zebras, you know, when they hear a lion coughing in the bush nearby. Whoop. It also is what lights up whenever we're upset. Get into an argument with your mate. Activation. Get fearful about something that might happen in the body, you know, or in the world. A lot of threats, by the way, are sensed internally, not just externally, both in terms of material or body sensations, that suddenly you go, what's that ache? Right? You ever have that happen? You get like a sharp pain in your knee and the first thought is, what's that? Is that a tumor? Or something like that, right? Okay. Sympathetic nervous system. Very useful to get away from tigers, or deal with traffic accidents, or if you have to mount a strong response, or to be excited about some guy who hits a crossbar, you know, a one in a million, he won 250,000 pounds for making that kick, you know, in that particular sporting event. There's a place for that. But on the other hand, chronic sympathetic activation is terribly pernicious to physical and mental health long term. And it's also problematic for meditation practice, because when we're activated, that really, when we're sympathetically activated, that activates attentional systems in the brain to scan, you know, or to really go into threats or opportunities. It's really hard to practice when your attention is bouncing around like, you know, a spotlight on speed, right? Skittering continually. How do you stabilize the mind? The antidote for sympathetic arousal is parasympathetic arousal. And the reason I'm doing this bizarre gesture is because they're like a seesaw. When sympathetic activation goes up, it pushes down parasympathetic activation. Whereas if you activate the parasympathetic, the rest and digest, so-called, wing of the autonomic nervous system, it downregulates the sympathetic wing. Right? Well, how do you do that? One way to do it is to use your mouth, because it's innervated. It's filled with fibers from the parasympathetic nervous system. So if you relax your jaw muscles, relax your tongue, and also really focus on exhaling, because parasympathetic handles exhaling, sympathetic handles inhaling. When you exhale, your heart rate slows down just a smidge. When you inhale, your heart rate speeds up. And you get that parasympathetic, sympathetic, parasympathetic, sympathetic activation. So also when you relax muscles in your body, you also get that parasympathetic activation. All right. Third one was about safety. I talked probably at some length about that. You can see up here those fancy words, amygdala, hippocampus. Those are part of the subcortical limbic region. Quick sidebar. There are two amygdalas or amygdalae. There are two hippocampuses or hippocampi, because the brain is bilaterally divided for most of its elements. The convention is to speak of them in the singular, but there are really two of them, left and right. All right, that said, we'll just, you know, talk about them in the singular. The amygdala is the alarm bell in the brain, and it registers great threat or great opportunity. It's mostly focused on threats, right? The brain is biased toward threat response. And so a lot of the time what's happening is the amygdala is banging the bell saying, look out, look out, look out, look out, look out, do something. Hippocampus is involved in remembering or things, particularly context or setting, and also visual spatial memory. And so that's kind of a circuit in the brain. When you dampen your sense of threat, when you help yourself feel as safe as is reasonable, all right? And there are many settings where it would be foolish to feel safe, because they're not, right? But to feel as safe as is appropriate or reasonable, as you legitimately deserve, when you do that, you are calming, you are down-regulating, you are soothing, you are desensitizing. They are getting less active, these, you know, limbic alarm bells. Next one, positive emotion. It's very important in many, many regards, and it's very interesting that in the Dharma, positive emotion is so emphasized. When I first came to Buddhism, you know, my impression of it was that it was this really grim, glum trip, right? Like suffering. Ugh. And I'm a California guy, like, right? We don't like to suffer. What? And it's not just Californians who don't like to suffer. So, yeah, if you read the Dharma, it's interesting how much they talk about happiness. Gladdening the heart, tranquility, the joy of giving, generosity, as we'll get to later, bliss, rapture, contentment, tranquility. Two of the seven factors of enlightenment, awakening, are affectively positive, emotionally positive, rapture and tranquility. Two of the five, arguably three of the five factors of the jhanas, the deep states of absorption, that constitute the wise or right concentration element of the Eightfold Noble Path, are affectively positive. Positive emotion does lots of things. One, it feels good. Two, it motivates people to keep going. Three, it establishes rewards, so we start inclining in a certain direction. Four, it stabilizes attention. My main focus today is on steadying the mind. That's just one aspect of practice, obviously. We can't do everything today. But it's one really, really important part. And I want to explain how attention works kind of briefly, right? Because if you want to steady the mind, that means holding something in awareness, holding the breath in awareness, or holding your wife's kind of complex story about some upset with the in-laws, right, in mind, or holding your husband, or whatever your relationship is, you know, same sex, whatever, or transcending sex, whatever. Whatever the relationship is with you're with someone, you know, kind of keeping your attention in the game, or paying attention in a boring business meeting at the end of a long day when you're running out of blood sugar. You know, you really want to hold something in working memory, in what people call the global workspace of consciousness or awareness, or the mental chalkboard. All right, so let's talk about how it works. Because if you want to be mindful, if you want to be concentrated, that's about attention. So how does attention work? Neurologically, I mean, attention is complex and there are systems of attention, but to really boil it down, if you think of what is an awareness right now, it's sort of like you can think of it as a pasture with fences around it and a gate, right? So there's a field and a gate. What we're aware of is what's in the field and it's gated. And then when our attention moves to something else, the gate pops open, something new comes in, and it shoves the other thing out of the field. Right? Well, the way that basically is handled in the brain is through this ingenious system in which a certain neurotransmitter called dopamine, which is associated with steady rewards or the fulfillment of expectations for rewards, is steady. So as long as you get steady dopamine, the gate stays closed and you just kind of stay with what you're aware of. For example, imagine a monkey in a tree chomping on a bunch of bananas. Right? Steady stream of rewards. The monkey stays focused on this tree, these bananas, right? But if the bananas run out in this tree and the reward stream drops, which means dopamine levels drop, dopamine slumps, boop, gate pops open. And there then becomes a notion, oh, look around, other trees, other bananas, what should I do? You know, other opportunities, right? On the other hand, if, let's say, there's a cough of a lion down below, right? Threat. Dopamine spikes, gate pops open, monkey starts looking for the threat. Or alternately, there's a another monkey, some kind of cute monkey, swings onto a branch nearby. Whatever is a cute monkey for the initial monkey, whatever works for that monkey, you know. And suddenly, boo! A new opportunity. Dopamine spikes. Gate pops open. What bananas, right? Got an opportunity here. See how it works? That's how attention works. And as I'll talk about later, people really vary in several different things. They vary on how satiated they get with, or how long they can actually stay with what's in the field of awareness. They also vary in how permeable the fences are for the pasture, and therefore creating distraction that kind of leaks through. And also how much they want stimulation. People really naturally vary. And we'll talk about neurologically based diversity later on. But the point is that, remember this, steady dopamine? If you're feeling really happy, even in subtle ways, like really contented, or really peaceful, or really grateful, or really kind, all those are affectively positive and are rewarding, you're going to get steady dopamine, and you're going to get high levels at the top of its range. So you can't get a spike. See? High levels of ongoing happiness maintain steady dopamine at the top of its range. So it keeps the gate closed because it's steady, and it prevents spiking. See? Isn't that interesting? It's like a neurological explanation for why two of the five jhana factors are happiness, including a very, very rewarding jhana factor being bliss. Bliss is pretty rewarding, wouldn't you say? You know, that really keeps dopamine at the top of its stream. The other thing that positive emotion does is that it stimulates with a norepinephrine, which is another neurotransmitter as well as hormone. It's related to stress response, sure, but it brightens the mind. It's a general alerting or orienting neurotransmitter. If you're starting to slump and kind of space out and get tired or sleepy in practice, sometimes it helps to just kind of like send an internal signal to yourself, almost wake up. Or in Tibetan practice, they'll talk about visualizing light, which probably through some trick that I don't know about and I don't think anyone does, stimulates norepinephrine activation. One nice thing about norepinephrine and dopamine is that they promote the formation of synapses. In other words, as we learn, what that means is we're building neural structure. I'll talk about how that happens better in a moment. But if you think about it, the path of practice is learning. The question is, what's our learning curve in life? You know, we cannot do anything about what happened in the past. We cannot do even anything about this moment. Because once this moment emerges into existence in ways that are remarkable, because it's always now, right? But once this moment becomes now, it's congealed, it's set. Nothing you can do about it. But what we can do in each moment is do the best we can within the range of possibility in this moment, right? And we can learn the most from this moment. We can tend to the causes, as Ajahn Chah, one of the main teachers in the stream that ended up with Gaia House and London Insight, said, you can tend to the causes in the moment of a better future. The question in life for me a lot is within the range that's available to us in each moment, which rises or falls depending on the nature of the moment, within that range, moment by moment by moment, as we proceed across the lifespan, do we do what we best can at the top of that range of possibility or at the low end of the range of possibility? Any increment between the best we can do and the worst we can do at any moment is fairly small, right? But those increments add up, and the result of that, the choices we make moment by moment by moment as we proceed in life, lead to a learning curve that's relatively flat, moderate, or really steep. Or honestly, in the case of some people who shall be nameless who recently ran America, no learning curve at all. Actually, they learn less at the end of 8 years than they did at the beginning. Or they know less at the end of 8 years, really. So, learning curve. So how do we have a learning curve, right? It's interesting to think about the path of practice, the path of awakening, as a process of learning. We're learning, right? Well, that means you're changing neural structure. How do you change neural structure? You stitch neurons together at the point where they meet, called synapses. What promotes synaptic formation? Dopamine and norepinephrine. How do you get dopamine and norepinephrine? Positive emotion. As well as other things too, like being in a war zone. Because again, you're going to get a lot of dopamine or norepinephrine from massive amounts of threat. But you can trick the brain to produce lots of dopamine and norepinephrine to really encourage the lessons of practice sticking to the ribs and sinking in by associating them with positive emotion. Okay. So one thing, one reason why I think the most successful teachers have happy students, right? And it's not just that they're happy because they're learning because they're happy, right? Happiness is skillful means. The last one is absorbing the benefits. I said earlier that sticks are more important than evolution. Sticks are more powerful than carrots in evolution. They're not better than carrots. In other words, threats are more important to pay attention to than carrots, than opportunities. In other words, you miss out on an opportunity today in the Serengeti or, 30 million years ago, let's say. Usually you have a chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you don't duck a stick today, you're not going to have a crack at a carrot tomorrow, right? And so the brain has a built-in negativity bias. It preferentially looks for, reacts to, stores, and retrieves negative information. It's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones, right? It is, actually. So the way it's important, therefore, to kind of make up for that built-in bias. The brain is biased toward gene copies. It's biased against quality of life. In many ways, the brain is biased against the path of practice. A lot of practice swims against the streams of evolution. There are aspects of our endowment in the brain that are pro-practice, but a lot of what we do actually goes against the innate and very strong capacities and inclinations of the brain toward greed, hatred, and delusion. And so to me, that takeaway from that is self-compassion. And also realize, wow, I got to get some resources going here because I'm, swimming against the stream. I can't just sort of space out and float around because the natural tendency is to drive me into greed, hatred, and delusion. So by really intending and taking some time to let these positive experiences, subtle even, whatever they were in a sitting, sink in. In other words, by holding them in awareness as long as possible, making them as intense as possible, and making them as bodily felt as possible, that maximally promotes the formation of neural circuits. That's a general principle. In other words, the more intense something is, the more bodily experienced something is, and the longer something is experienced, the more chance you have to get those neurons firing together and stitching together. I did the fourth chapter of my book. I did a workshop on taking in the good. This is an example of why it's so important to what the Buddha said, cultivate. Cultivation or bhavana, to really internalize wholesome qualities that and increasingly incline the mind in that direction. There's a classic saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together, wire together. At a deep level of the brain, it's pretty mechanistic. The more they fire, the longer they fire, and the more of them that fire, the better the wiring is, the more the wiring is. Okay, any comments or questions so far? I'm just like, just what? Numbed you. The fire hose of information. Yes, no? Any comment or question? Okay. Yes, no. Okay. I'm going to zip along and then we'll take a little break. How's that? How about it? All right? So let me just see what I want to do here. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to zip through some basic material. I want to really, control my tendency to go off topic and budget time so we can really have good time for experiential practices today. So this is where I'm going to work. I'm going to talk at the intersection of these three circles. It's historically unprecedented to be able to do this. It's kind of remarkable, isn't it? Now, I'd like to address a question that naturally arises up front. What about God? What about capital C consciousness? What about capital B Buddha nature? What about capital S self, right? And basically, as I said, are the two possibilities that there is an X factor and there isn't, right? There is something transcendental or there isn't, right? Of those two, I personally am a transcendentalist. I think there is an X factor. I think 300 years from now, science will come to the end of all possible explanations for every single feature of consciousness and will realize that there's some irreducible X factor that's outside the system. On the other hand, some people very legitimately think, nope, it's all in the meat. That's the way it is. I remember Andy Alinsky saying to me once, he's a teacher, you probably know, and a scholar, wonderful teacher and scholar at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. He said, you know, one view of what the Buddha taught, and happens to be his own view, perhaps Stephen's bachelor's as well, is essentially what the Buddha said is, it's just causes rolling along groundlessly, deal with it. You know, so that said, I'm going to stay within the frame of Western science today. And I'm going to deal with what Western science has to offer about, you know, the path of awakening as embedded in and expressed through material processes deep down. So to that end, you saw this, right? You saw that slide, which I didn't realize I had, but it's a good slide. So with a big bow in the direction of the transcendental, which, by the way, is appropriate to acknowledge the possibility of. You can't prove it either way. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? And so to me, a genuinely scientific attitude, to me, a number of scientists are true believers, except in the other direction, right? They're true believers that there is no transcendental, and you get very staunch about advocating against it, partly because politically today, organized religion is associated with various things, good or bad. But I think that's an ultimately unscientific attitude. If you can't prove it either way, why rule it out, right? Yes, please.
Can you just define what you mean by transcendental?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And also, through the practice of meditation, we tend to get individuals to reach the same insight. And how is that possible if we're not saying that there is a transcendental? Could you just say a bit about that?
Sure. So by transcendental, I mean God or spirit, or the ground, or the nameless. I don't mean feeling really peaceful when we're in the forest. I mean the big Megillah, you know, whatever that is, right? I mean anything outside the fundamental frame of materiality, which is quite extraordinary in its own right. I mean, it includes dark matter, black holes, weird quantum phenomena, you know, crazy stuff. I mean, outside of that frame even. That's what I mean. That's what people mean when they talk about ultimately that. And in the Western tradition of looking at consciousness, or the Eastern as well, there's a huge emphasis on the transcendental as a fundamental source. And what the amazing thing has been, which has also stirred up a lot of resistance in a lot of quarters, is that Western science is increasingly showing, as I'll show you in a few minutes, that as we keep discovering with increasing granularity and increasing breadth that the mind is what the brain does. All right? So the necessity of a transcendental explanation outside the frame of Western science keeps seemingly to shrink. All right? So that's what I mean by the transcendental, your first question. And then the second thing is, how would people come to the same result through practice? Well, one answer to that, of course, is that there's, for example, just one God and we're all arising as God, and or there is a disembodied, you know, Judeo-Christian, which includes, you know, Islamic or the Abrahamic traditions, you know, of the personality of the deity, who's leading us all in the same direction. That's one explanation. Can't rule it in, can't rule it out, right? Bow to it. On the other hand, another explanation is we all have the same brain, right? We all have the same brain, barring some, you know, there are subtle individual differences, but the build-out is this very, very similar person to person to person. And we all end up in the same place when we start seeing very deeply into the nature of the brain, which produces the nature of the mind, embedded in the nature of the world and the nature of materiality altogether, right? So, okay. John, it's really a great question. I've never been asked that before. Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Okay, I'll keep going, if I could. So this is probably the most conceptually important and, you know, slide here. So I just kind of want to talk through it. A lot of controversies, in my experience, get resolved when you define your terms clearly. That's why, for example, I'll tend to use the word awareness rather than consciousness. Consciousness has a lot of pretty intense religious, philosophical connotations, East and West. So by mind, I mean the flow of information through the nervous system. In other words, if you think about it, there are all kinds of examples of where immaterial information is supported by a material substrate. In other words, the information on this slide is embedded in the material substrate of the little squiggles here and the contrast between what's essentially dark and what's light. Right? Similarly, the material substrate of the air molecules in this room is carrying sound waves which are patterned with meaning, immaterial meaning. Make sense? Okay, radio waves play a song. You know, we have, you know, electromagnetic waves, those material in some sense. E equals MC squared, right? In their pattern, and they carry information. Same thing happens in the nervous system. It moves signals around. The information, the brain, the nervous system moves information around like the heart moves blood around. All right? In that frame, there's a one-to-one correspondence between what the mind is doing and what the brain is doing. Most of the mind is forever outside of awareness. The little part that we are actually aware of moment to moment is the tip of the iceberg above the waterline. The rest of it is momentarily beneath the waterline, and actually most of the mind, most of the information streaming through the nervous system is forever outside of awareness. That's why I think it's so interesting that the Buddha emphasized so much the cultivation of wholesome factors that then become internalized outside of awareness and yet still help us greatly. I wrote a review of a recent book called Wrapped about attention, which draws on a lot of mindfulness teachings for Tricycle magazine, in which I took a little bit of a contrarian view that obviously mindfulness is important for foundations of mindfulness, major path of practice, and all the rest of that. That said, I think sometimes we can, you know, conflate Buddhism with mindfulness, right? Or we can conflate, you know, the path of transformation is somehow only produced through mindfulness, whereas there are a lot of other important factors. So that said, as your brain changes, your mind changes. For example, have a cup of coffee in the morning, you're changing your brain. Or bonk yourself in the head, you're changing your brain. When you change your brain or have a stroke or whatnot or dement in old age, the brain changes, the mind changes. Going the other way, as the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, as you are understanding what I'm saying and you're thinking about other things and sensing things, looking out the window, whatever, right here and now, in ways I'll explain in a moment, your brain is changing. Different circuits are firing, different coalitions are forming, there are different ebbs and flows, tidal currents of neurotransmitters moving around, you know, active regions of the brain are grabbing more, you know, oxygen and glucose from the blood, other parts are getting quiet. You know, in other words, mental activity changes maps to neural activity, both temporarily and in terms of creating lasting changes in the brain. And I want to show you a slide about that right here. In other words, part of the recent breakthroughs of brain science that are very germane to the path of practice go speak to what's called neuroplasticity. Most neuroplasticity is very humdrum and modest. Like, for example, do you remember what you had for breakfast this morning? Please say you did. I'm going to worry about you if you don't remember what you had for breakfast. If you had or it's okay if you remember that you had no breakfast, although I would say breakfast is important. But anyway, let's see. Can you remember something you did last summer? It's been a bit of a blur for me, but yeah. How do you remember that? Something had to change in your brain for you to remember that, right? Brain changes occur through lots of methods, through the flow of immaterial mental activity. The slide lists some of the major ways it occurs. There is what's called neuronal pruning, for example, use it or lose it, neural Darwinism. Certain regions of the brain are used. A toddler, a three-year-old, has roughly three times as many synapses. I don't see any toddlers in the room. Three times as many synapses as we do today. On the other hand, doesn't mean a toddler is smarter. I think we're certainly more developed mentally than a toddler is at this point. It's because even though some synapses are lost, they weren't that actually useful. And we've really built out the ones that are important. And as you can see here as well, there's the larger point that neurons that fire together wire together, literally firing simultaneously, which means they're communicating with each other, leads them to stitch more together. Okay. Experience matters. That's the takeaway point here, both for what it feels like in the moment and for the lasting residues it leaves behind. You know, whatever neurons are firing, they're wiring, for better or for worse. In other words, if we rest our mind on themes that are upsetting or negativistic or frightening or make us angry or make us feel inadequate or despair, we are wiring those neurons together. On the other hand, if we rest our attention on themes of understanding and insight, of caring for other beings, of caring for ourselves, which is incredibly important in the path of practice, then we are starting to wire those kind of neurons together. The takeaway point is that because the mind changes the brain and the brain changes the mind, you can use your mind to change your brain to benefit your mind. And to benefit all beings whose life you touch, ultimately rippling out perhaps to include all beings, human and otherwise, on this planet. It's always been understood that if you did mental activity A, you could get various kinds of mental results C, right? What was not understood is the black box. What's increasingly understood are the neural states that underlie positive mental states of interest. And so by studying people like the contemplatives, the serious long-term contemplatives, are sort of the Olympic athletes, it's said, of mental training. By studying those folks and then reverse engineering and, you know, plausibly at the leading edge of science these days, so with a lot of humility and some major holes in what we know, plausibly reverse engineering and trying to figure out what are the neural states that underlie, that correlate with and that promote those mental states of interest, then by understanding what those neural states are, we can start figuring out, how can I do mental activity A over here to trigger and stimulate and therefore strengthen? As soon as you stimulate, you're strengthening because you're firing and therefore you're wiring those neural states that really underscore, you know, where we want to go with our life. So that's the opportunity, to use the mind to change the brain to benefit the whole being and every other being whose life we touch. And that's what, you know, the focus is on applied neurodharma. Right. So, discussion or comments so far? You again. Good.
Can you define mind better than your body? So when you work on your body, can that change your brain?
I'm defining mind as information. So it's by definition not the body. Now, most of the information flying through the nervous system is in response to changes in the body. So it's, we could certainly say, bodily referenced information. And that said, the body, therefore, is really, really important. And one of the interesting findings and developments in Western science is that cognition, seemingly pure, lofty reason, is heavily embodied. And working with the body is very important in the path of practice. So I think using the body is really, really important and very, very interesting. The result of movements in the body, you know, translate into, you know, mental factors. In other words, in terms of information streaming through the nervous system, and then those mental factors are what we work with. Okay? Okay, great. Yeah, in the back. What do you mean? Oh, thank you.
I mean, you're talking about two different things that impact. You're not just saying that the mind is one thing.
Let me clarify something or kind of unpack something and then see if that speaks to your comment here, if I could. The brain is nested in the nervous system, which is intertwining with other major systems in the body like the immune system and the hormone system. And it's nested in the larger body, which is nested in the world, in a larger network of causes and conditions that basically boil down to, you know, biological nature, physical materiality, and culture, both here and now, and then based on a long stream of causes reaching back, you know, to the Big Bang, ultimately. That's a very interdependent view. And again, that's the emerging view. That's very consistent with the Dharma. You know, you get from quantum physics here and deep ecology there, and now this increasingly understood, embodied and enactivist view of mental activity that you really can't make a sharp division altogether. And all that said, the brain is the necessary condition for the mind, as I'm defining it. You can't have an information flow in the nervous system without a brain. Right, as I'm defining mind here, outside of a transcendental factor. And the brain is also the proximally sufficient condition for mind. It's not the completely sufficient condition for mind. You can't have mind without culture, right? You take children and you put them in a cave and or in a cellar in a home and you keep them there for 12 years. Or they leave, somehow they wander off as a baby in India and they're raised in the forest somehow by wolves or whatever. You know, and then they're recovered to civilization, if that's the right word. They come back to civilization when they're 8 or 12. That person is permanently damaged as far as a human possibility is. You can't have mind without culture. But locally, proximally, my view, and it's a generally held view, is the brain is the necessary and proximally sufficient condition for the mind, as I'm defining these terms. Okay, so does that clarify, or do you have a response to that or a question about that? Say that again.
Would you still not have a mind even if you didn't have culture?
That's correct. You would have in those people who are natural experiments, right? Obviously, we're not going to construct an experiment like that. They do have mind in the sense of information flow. I mean, they have sensory information, perceptual information. They're capable of developing rudimentary language. They have motivational information, limbic information. Sure, in that sense, they're having mind. But it's a very damaged mind.
Yeah, sure.
Is that's clear? Okay, thank you. Yeah, please.
The damaged mind, but it could be healed through the meditative process, through sort of restarting those
right. So the question is, the question is, a natural one, of course, to what extent can a damaged mind be healed? Whether it's an extreme case, you know, of someone who's been raised without language for the first 6 years of their life, let's say, or more subtle forms of damage, like, you know, having a rocky childhood or a really crummy divorce, right? Really. Or being in combat. And the American estimates in the Pentagon are that a third of the people coming back from the Middle East have PTSD. I mean, literally. Which, interestingly, has made the Pentagon very open to very exotic practices. I have a friend named Richard Miller who teaches, he's a major yoga psychologist, speaking of the body, teaches yoga nidra, this very profound, deep system, you know, that I don't understand that well, but he does. And he's paid by the Defense Department to go into the Veterans Administration hospitals and do yoga nidra programs with vets because they're looking for anything that will help. Just, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, the father too, I hope. But anyway, so the question is, how much can be healed? That's kind of, I can't go too much into that direction. I guess I'll make three comments about it. One, there is a lot of breaking news science, and it's often the most glamorous and kind of sexy neuroscience stuff, about people who've had massive injuries, damages to different aspects of their brain that recovered most, if not all, of their function by other parts of the brain taking over, right? And that's sort of neuroplasticity on steroids. Really exciting stuff. Great. Second point is that because of the capacity of the brain to learn from experience, you know, sort of, you know, everyday neuroplasticity, humdrum neuroplasticity, I think that with sufficient effort, right? Effort. In each of these moments of life, someone who tries hard enough can have enormous rehabilitation. You know, I personally recovered from a lot of childhood experiences with peers and some family that really were difficult and had a lot of impact. You know, you have to do the work. You know the joke about how many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Do you know the answer? Only takes one. But the light bulb has to want to change. Right? We have to want to change. We have to do the work. Right? Being a therapist a long time has made me very compassionate and also very tough-minded. Because you roughly get what you earn on the path of life. Right? It's what you do moment by moment by moment at the high end of the range or the low end of the range, what the opportunity happens to be now and now and now. Those increments accumulate to be where we are. But that said, I'm very hopeful. I never want to give up. And to a fault, maybe, just keep at it. and want to help people, keeping at it. And that's the takeaway point. You can use your mind to change your brain in radical ways. You'd have to do the work and do it skillfully. That's where a little bit of understanding can help. How does the black box work? You know, it's kind of like a computer. If we knew nothing about how it worked, we would learn over time you could do certain keys. You could hit keys A and get result C on the screen. But by understanding better, you know, why Windows is such a nutty system and why Macs are better, I won't go there. You're then able to operate the keyboard more skillfully, A, because you understand the black box B and get the result C you really care about of what shows up on the screen. But you got to do the work and learn how to use the keys. The last thing is there are sensitive periods where seemingly, particularly with some major functions like language, if you don't get exposed to language in early childhood, you are forever have a major learning disability around language, minimally. You know, and there are other studies that show, for example, kittens. If kittens are raised in certain environments that are cleverly designed to have absolutely no vertical lines during a certain period, like I think it's around 6 weeks of life, they will forever after be unable to see vertical lines. And they will avoid horizontal bars, you know. They'll just back away from horizontal bars. But vertical bars, boom, they'll walk into because they don't see them, literally. Isn't that interesting? It's a sensitive period. And the same is true for horizontal bars at a different sensitive period. If they don't see the horizontal lines of any kind during a certain period, forever after they're unable to see them. So there are sensitive periods. But they're very, interestingly, minimal. I mean, there are enormous possibilities for people to really heal major difficult experiences. Okay, how about one more and then we'll take a break. Very good, yeah.
I'm just interested, because we're talking about, you know, that actually creating happiness leads to changing of the wiring of the brain. And then before that, you were talking about, in the meditation, you know, that actually trying to create safety or well-being can be threatening in itself. And both in my own practice, I'm very sensitive to include stuff like metta, compassion, any of that, because it can invoke actually the opposite response. So if you're trying to help yourself through difficulty or somebody else, how to approach something that will inspire happiness without creating that kind of
backlash or pushback?
Yeah.
Obviously a very interesting question. I don't know if I'm fully going to do justice to it. I think it's the kind of question we can reflect on a lot. I think one, understanding why it's all right. You know, that's top down. But understanding why it's all right to be happy. I think a lot of us have internalized all kinds of prohibitions and inhibitions about being happy. Because, for example, lots of kids, when they're really, really happy, they break the furniture. You know, the parents go, be quiet! You know, and they drive their parents crazy because they're having so much fun in the back seat of the car on a long road trip. So there becomes an association between happiness and, ooh, pain. Right? So people contract. Sometimes they don't feel like they deserve to be happy. I think gender socialization is that women tend to be socialized to focus first on the needs of others, as a generalization, their happiness before tending to their own happiness. Lots of exceptions to that. Lots of men will often take good care of the needs of others, but still, there is that, you know, common finding in the research. But not to get into gender, because it's pretty controversial, the point I'm trying to make here is that, number one, understand why it's okay to be happy. Number two, get on your own side. That's another thing. A lot of people are not for themselves. That's the first thing. You have to want to change. The light bulb has to want to change. Are you on your own side? That's an incredibly important question. You know, and so then stuff arises in the mind. Stuff constantly arises in the mind. But the question then becomes, how do we respond to it? Right? Are we on our own side about it? Wow. Is anyone feeling a little less safe? Isn't it interesting? It's really interesting to practice with feeling of threat maybe arising in the mind. Can you bring attention here, or maybe this is a good opportunity for a break? How about we take a break? 15 minutes? Please be back at noon.
I just took the battery.
We're doing okay. Yeah, good.